Today, a few thoughts, three poems, and a prayer about Memorial Day.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Every year, end of May, beginning of summer, as people think of it, we observe Memorial Day in the United States, and for good reason, obviously. And some people make a very big ceremonial deal of it, not only in their homes, on their lawns with a flag and observances of some kind, but also sometimes a church service, a trip to a local cemetery or a funeral home, or actually visiting the grave of a loved one that they've lost. So for some people, there is that formality to the observance of Memorial Day. For others, it's less formal. There is it is simply the beginning of summer, and there is a remembrance, I would say, for everyone I know and for almost everyone I can think of, there's some moment when they recall that there's a difference between Memorial Day and Labor Day. And I'm not saying that Labor Day shouldn't have some significance to it, but it is of a completely different kind than a Memorial Day, like a Veterans Day or some other observance that has to do with the solemnity and reverence of gratitude that we should have for our freedoms, for our existence as a nation, and so on. So there, almost everyone I know remembers that in some way or another, whether they formalize their observance of it or not. So I'm not presuming to lecture people who need to be reminded about the importance of Memorial Day. But there are a few things that I think are worth sharing, just as thoughts about Memorial Day as we lead into that weekend, as I'm recording this and as it will come out for you. And so, you know, one of the things I want to do is just talk about the history of it enough. I haven't done research. I didn't go read a book on Memorial Day for this. But I looked up a few facts just to make sure that I had a sense of where the observance, the regularity of the holiday comes from. But then in light of that, since, you know, Memorial Day is committed to this specific kind of observance, I wanted to recognize a few things about our response to it. So the things I think are right in our response to it, things I know are criticized in our response to it that I actually think are not all that bad, and you may disagree on that part, but I won't stay there very long. But then also something I think we should do more of in light of Memorial Day, things that I don't hear said often enough surrounding Memorial Day. And that doesn't mean anything other than that I haven't heard it very often. And so I just want to share it with you as well. And then draw a conclusion and offer a prayer at the end of the conversation. So, you know, with Memorial Day approaching, the final Monday, you know, of every May, we do this, observe Memorial Day. I grew up doing holidays. I mean, taking advantage of the holiday by having a church picnic, knowing that no one had to get up early the next day. We would do special things on Sunday. On Monday, people would invite others over to their homes. They would grill and, you know, all that kind of stuff. That was the standard fare for Memorial Day. A lot of people would make a vacation of it. People that I knew who had vacation homes would take that opportunity, or vacation lots in Colorado, for instance, would take that occasion to take their things up to Colorado and prepare for their summer season vacationing in Colorado. So, you know, for me, it is a day that I remember. When the end of May is coming, I recognize that there's a holiday there. It surprised me when I realized the short term of our history within which this holiday has been formalized as a federal holiday, as a national holiday. And also, if you had asked me, now I've known this for the last few years or maybe a couple of decades now, but if you had asked me as a young man, so when did Memorial Day take its form? What's it fashioned after? I would have said World War II. Hands down, no doubt, I would have said it as if it's a clear and obvious fact that everyone should be aware of. But I would have been completely wrong. Memorial Day was established, not even called Memorial Day, but became a consideration in our culture and a practice, even though not formalized, in our culture as an outflow of the Civil War. And so, you know, and by the way, I got all of this information that I'm about to share with you from history.com. It's basically the History Channel's history, you know, website, I think, is where that website comes from. But it's a good source of sort of popular intellectual level history. It's not researched history like the book on Eisenhower that I just read and enjoyed so much. But very informative, and it gets these ideas right, and it's clearly researched. So, you know, right after the Civil War was over, the very first people to sort of recognize the sacrifice, the lives that were lost in the Civil War, and you know, it was just a monumental loss of life in the Civil War, massive loss of life. The very first people to gather and recognize the sacrifice of the soldiers who had died were those who had been freed by the efforts of those soldiers. An observance that took place, I think, in one of the Carolinas, just after the close of the Civil War, just after the surrender of the Confederacy. So in May, most likely, because the surrender was in April of 1865, but in May, most likely, these freed former captives, former slaves, had a commemoration for the war dead. But historically, people look at, and I didn't know this, Waterloo, New York, from 1866, the following year. So again, this is just one full year after the surrender of the Confederacy in the Civil War, the War of Rebellion, as it was called at the time. In 1866, they actually formalized an observance in their community in Waterloo, New York, that became this annual observance. I mean, it was the whole community participated. It was for the sake of decorating graves and recognizing the sacrifice of these soldiers and others who had died in the rebellion, in the war. And they closed their businesses and made it a regular practice. And only a couple of years later, a general of the U.S. Army, I think John Logan was the name that I saw there, asked for a nationwide day, May 30th, for decorating veterans' graves. It didn't become a holiday or day off, but it was just a day to recognize that we should go to the cemeteries, we should decorate the graves of veterans from the Civil War at the time is what he was asking for. And you can see that May 30th sort of becomes the standard date. So the Civil War is the thing. Now, what's really interesting is if you go to Civil War battle sites, right, battlefields, then you also discover a lot of activity statues and commemorative plaques and museums established and things like that during the period just before and during and after World War I. And that was the first time when I was visiting some of those battlefields, Gettysburg and others. That was the first time that it dawned on me how proximate in time the Civil War was to World War I. And even reading about some of the things that transpired in World War I, you read about men who were involved in the Civil War having a key role in World War I as well. And so it's not a surprise that in the development of Memorial Day and its significance and its sort of nationalization, it's becoming a regular practice. It become a much more a regularly observed practice through the era surrounding World War I. And by 1890, all the northern states had a regular time of observing Memorial Day, I think May 30th. But the southern states all observed it in some way, but on different dates, different times. But they did have some observance of Decoration Day. But the But it becomes regularized just after that. And in World War I, especially, just after World War I, nationwide, everybody's observing some kind of Decoration Day. And this is interesting to me that it took this long, but over the decades, people are practicing this, observing this in May, and doing all kinds of things, practicing all kinds of traditions, creating traditions. But it's not until the late 1960s, that it finally becomes the final Monday in May. And that ruling actually doesn't even take effect until 1971, when I'm 8 years old, by the way. And there was a shift from calling it Decoration Day, which meant go to the graveside and actually decorate the graves of veterans, honor them in that way and their sacrifice in that way, to becoming Memorial Day, the day that we now recognize and the way we recognize it. And it moved, obviously, to the final Monday of the month of May so that we could have a three-day holiday, you know, so that federal employees can have a three-day holiday, and nationwide it became this three-day holiday, and which is a good way to have an observance like this. So no criticism implied here. I'm just recounting the history so we have a sense of where it came from, and it really came from families that were just devastated nationwide at the loss of their loved ones in the Civil War and the recognition that that brought, which nothing else might have brought, of how great the sacrifice is when a soldier or an airman or whoever is lost in a conflict like that. And so we'll comment more on that in just a moment. But that leads naturally and easily into the conversation about what we do right on Memorial Day. And I'm not saying every person does this or that we all do it correctly, and nor that there's a single way to do this correctly. I don't mean that at all. But I mean, what we do right is simply this. We honor our war dead. That is the right thing to do. We're not practicing some kind of ritualistic worship of ancestors when we do this, but we are recognizing the incredible loss of life and the value of those lives that has been lost to us, but the gain that we have because of the sacrifice that they paid. And I'll leave it at that right now. We'll give more nuance to it in a moment. But this first step of it is simply that we honor our dead, and doing that on Memorial Day in a prayer. You know, I always do my devotionals in the morning. I'm reading or listening to scripture as I have breakfast. I pray. I prepare for the day. And on Memorial Day, recognizing that you give part of that devotional over to a time to say thank you to the Lord for how he provided for us through an awful sacrifice. And I am talking about the sacrifice of our war dead. There is a poem that has sort of become a standard poem reflecting the value of Memorial Day and honoring our war dead. And it actually became a practice in some, and in some of the smaller cities where I've done interim pastorates and I've served to just fill the pulpit and things, I've seen people do this. In some of the larger, more urban settings, I haven't seen it as often, but I'm not saying it's not practiced as often. I just haven't noticed it as consistently. But in a lot of outlying areas, rural areas, even in Texas, I have observed people on Memorial Day wearing poppies, red poppies, as an observance of Memorial Day. And I didn't know why that was, until I was teaching poetry. And in this poetry class that I was teaching, one of the poems that popped up as a candidate for something to teach from was this poem, In Flanders Fields, by John McCrae, who himself was a Canadian and served with the British forces obviously in Northern Europe, or in Europe, during World War I. And he was a physician, and so he tended to the ill, attended to those who had been injured and were ill. And one of the people he tended to was a good friend of his who died in the far northern reaches of France, or maybe the far western northern reaches of Belgium, and in Flanders Fields, so near Dunkirk in that area if it were in France. And so In Flanders Fields goes like this. This is the poem. So what I want to do is, I said three poems and a prayer, and I mean it. So a poem for each of these little comments that I want to make. But the poem itself is a beautiful poem, recognizing the sacrifice, not pretending that, not glorifying it, not just lionizing the people who died, but really recognizing the sacrifice and the loss, but also the importance that we carry forward something in order to honor them. And so here's how he conveys it. And in this, I want you to be listening for the spirituality and the soul and the eternal wind, you know, how wind reflects spirit in scripture and in imagery. And so you're looking for that and the obvious image of the poppies coming up from the ground, carrying the red color, just like so many images of those who die and offer a sacrifice on our behalf. A tree blossoms and bears red blooms or things like that. So, you know, obviously the red poppies have something to do with this as well. But also the contrast between what's above, the busyness of the activity above the fields, and then the repose of those who are now below the fields. So notice that difference. And then the importance at the end of carrying forward the responsibility that's ours. So here's how the poem goes. In Flanders fields, the poppies blow between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place. And in the sky, the larks, still bravely singing, fly scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago, we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved. And now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you, from failing hands, we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields. So you can hear, and taking this position, this physician, John McCrae, taking the position of speaking, writing this poem from the perspective of those who have died, it's their opportunity to speak back to us our responsibility. And so that's what they do. And in his expressing what, you know, he saw in the faces of his patients, this, in, you know, Flanders Fields is one of the places where for the very first time, chlorine gas was used, for instance. And so there was just a mass murder, slaughter of soldiers on both sides of the line in different ways. But he saw brutality and soldiers perishing in his arms. And his ability then to take that voice that was being lost in front of him and put it into a poem that calls out to us from the past and says, don't forget us. We know the lark is above and is still singing, but you can't hear it above the noise of the guns. And so what you want to think about is just the noise of the guns that are going on around you. And then if you could, even if you could get rid of that, if you could eliminate the conflict that's there, then you would just want to look past that to the sound of the lark in the sky, flying, busy, things going on in life that are beautiful and appreciated. But the call of those who are below the field is for us not to forget, not just them, but also the reason that they died, and for us to carry forward with honor, to carry the honor, the torch, the tradition, the significance, the responsibility forward. It's a really beautiful poem. And so I would encourage you to go look it up again. We'll link to it or post it. But it's In Flanders Fields by John McCrae. I'm sure you've read it before, heard it before. And on Memorial Day, it's a beautiful poem to read. If you have kids at home, read it to your kids. It's just a great opportunity to share a tradition that's been handed down to us of not dismissing as insignificant the sacrifice that someone makes on our behalf. Now, because that's so grave, because it requires so much reverence, it is for some people practically offensive that we would have picnics and, you know, celebrations in the same way. And yet, this is where I'll pause just briefly, and I won't take very long on this section, but I will pause to defend those who use Memorial Day as just a day to picnic and have a great time with family and play games and just have a day off from work and then initiate the summer. You know, the first swim, the first whatever is going on. And I don't mean to defend them in some shallow way as if everyone has pure and innocent motives. I don't mean that. But I do mean this. There is, even among people who are at a funeral, and this just happened recently. I attended the funeral of someone who used to be on faculty at Criswell College, and it was a beautiful funeral. It was perfectly appropriate for that faculty member. And there was a sense of, first, the loss to our community of a really bright light and a kind personality and someone who had contributed much to the lives of so many people. But there was also a jocularity to it, because this person was a living person who had jokes in every moment of their life. And so there was a lot of lightheartedness and not just gallows humor, and not just humor to break the severity of the moment, but to celebrate the value of what this person had given us in this life. And so in exactly that same way, I think having picnics on Memorial Day and breaking out the barbecue grill and everyone celebrating is a way to say, you didn't just give us a legacy of death and sorrow, that what you gave us was a legacy of freedom and the occasion to be alive with our families. And the fact that you lost your family brings us tremendous grief, but even more gratitude for how much God has blessed us with because of your sacrifice. And I know that not everyone's going to articulate that, not everyone's going to think all the way through it, but when you see the freedom that was protected by those gifts, by those sacrifices, when you see the liberties that were often created by it in the Civil War, for instance, then I think it appropriate if you see anyone actually living in that freedom and behaving in a part, in their part of society, to say that they're grateful to be alive and to be here. It's a good thing. Now, I'm not saying it's the only thing. I just think it's tolerable. It's not a bad way to recognize what's going on Memorial Day. Two more things, which means two more poems as well. One, what I wish we did more. Well, actually, both of these fit in the category of what I wish we did more of. And number one is realize just how terrible war is. I have not been to war, and I don't regret that. I'm grateful to the Lord that I've never been to war. But in another sense, I regret it because I can't speak with truth to those who have been to war the things that they know that I will never know or understand. And again, I wouldn't make the exchange. I'm not saying, oh, I wish I'd been in war. I know not to say that because I've heard from enough people who've been in war that that would be a foolish thing to say. But also, I think I myself recognize war is evil, and I don't want to be a part of that any more than they wanted to be a part of it. But I think us remembering that and recognizing how terrible it is important. And there are reminders we have. We have these little inclinations to be aware. Right now, when we see on the news what's happening with Russia and Ukraine, and the images of bodies strewn in the streets, the stories of a grandfather going out just to get bread and being shot by a sniper. When we hear those things, when we read those things, then we realize it's not a game. It's not something for a person to pontificate about on cable news. Well, this is what happens in war. That's okay. It's not okay. It's horrible. And we should recognize that. My first observances of this came in the research, of how severe it is, came in the research I was doing on my dissertation, a long time ago. But I had to research the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, and it was crippling. To me, emotionally, just to read about it, the thought of having been in the region, much less having been present, I can't fathom it. And so, just the horror of it. And what affected me, I think, worse than that was the research I did just before that on the same, and this was in the same spell of research, on the Second Sino-Japanese War, the conflict between China and Japan that led into World War II, that was a part of what was leading into World War II, and the brutality of what was happening in China. I can barely even think about it without losing my way. And, evidence that we should recognize this, that we should we should embrace the truth that war is awful. Comes from the fact that, and I'll say it as close as I can to the factually accurate way, but those of you who are presidential historical experts will know I probably get this slightly wrong. But the author of the most recent book I read on Eisenhower that I mentioned a moment ago, Eisenhower and War and Peace, he mentions this several times throughout the book, that the two American presidents who never lost an American soldier or an American, you know, military person in battle overseas, I think that's the way to say it, were Grant and Eisenhower. Ulysses S. Grant, you know, the general from the Civil War. And then Dwight D. Eisenhower, the general from World War II. They are the two. And you shouldn't make the mistake of thinking, well, that was because they came out of a huge war and there was no opportunity for more conflict. That's not the case at all. If you know Eisenhower's history, you know he had opportunity after opportunity after opportunity to send American troops to resolve things directly, resolve things in a warlike fashion, to use nuclear weapons again. All of those occasions in him and in Grant, they were met. And I'm not saying this is universally consistent. I'm not saying it's true domestically, not dealing with any of that stuff. I'm just bringing this up to say, because they recognized and came out of, this seems the most likely explanation, because they recognized and came out of the horrors of war itself, they wanted to do everything humanly possible to avoid war. And these were warriors who were making these decisions. And so in light of that, I want to read you this poem by Carl Sandburg. It's called Iron. And what it does, and I'll just read it to you and not make a lot of comments on this one. It marries together the two children of iron, the steel of weapons and then the iron of a shovel, right? And so it puts them together in this poem to make the point. Carl Sandburg. Guns, long steel guns, pointed from warships in the name of the war god. Straight, shining, polished guns, clambered over with jackies and white blouses, glory of tan faces, tousled hair, white teeth, laughing, lithe jackies in white blouses, sitting on the guns, singing war songs, war chanties. Shovels, broad iron shovels, scooping out oblong vaults, loosening turf, and leveling sod. I ask you to witness, the shovel is brother to the gun. He wrote that in 1914, which is, by the way, the beginning of World War I. So he's writing it in the context of World War I breaking out and soldiers beginning to go into battle again, and in this case, sailors preparing to go into battle. And I will say, if you have the opportunity to go and read it, again, it's called Iron by Carl Sandburg. These are all available publicly on the web. If you have an opportunity to go and read it, notice that the jackies, who are so alive and lithe and tanned in face and all of that with the white teeth, that they're in white blouses twice, which means they're prepared for death. This is the idea behind that. Of course, they're dressed for the battle and they're shining and gleaming in their energy and vitality, but there's no doubt he's leaning toward the shovel end of it, where we are loosening the turf first and then leveling the sod over the grave at the end. So something to keep in mind. This doesn't mean, I'm not a pacifist. It doesn't mean there's no time for war. It doesn't mean it's not the best response sometimes. But it does mean we should do a better job of recognizing how terrible it is when it happens. The last thing we should be spending is our most valuable commodity, our young people in war. That's not a line from me. That's a line from several presidents. So with that said, the last observation I want to make, things that I wish we were doing more of, has to do with seeing wars more in their eternal or even longer term temporal context. So that by that I mean, we should see war in light of eternity, or just see war in light of the long scope of history. And this is what Carl Sandburg again does in this poem called Statistics. It refers to Napoleon. And again, I'm just going to read it to you, But I would ask you to pay attention to these things as I'm reading it through to you so that it'll sort of make sense in one reading. It's hard to get a poem in one reading. But what you'll hear is Napoleon, who fought all of these battles that involved exactly the same ground that's being fought over in World War I. From Calais, he's going to mention from Calais to Moscow. So Russia's involved, France is involved, Napoleon's won these great victories, and what's the consequence of it? Well, Napoleon's in the grave, and what you'll hear as I'm reading the poem is, Napoleon's in the grave, the soldiers are on the ground and they're marching again, and the airplanes are droning overhead, but the thing that's, so where all the busyness is, you know, on the ground with the soldiers and the guns and the aeroplanes, he refers to them as aeroplanes, this is World War I. With all of those things going on, the things that don't change are the grave, where Napoleon is just lying and rolls back over when he hears that they're battling again for no big deal, because it's just ground that he already conquered. Why are we fighting over it again? And then the stars in the heaven, which always reflect this fixity of the universe, because the stars don't change. They're still there. One person can rule, one person can win, one person can claim the ground, but the same stars are going to shine tomorrow. That's the idea that he's going to convey. So let me read it to you as he says it. Napoleon shifted, restless in the old sarcophagus, and murmured to a watch guard, "Who goes there?" The answer, 21 million men, soldiers, armies, guns, 21 million afoot, horseback, in the air, under the sea. And Napoleon turned to his sleep. It is not my world answering. It is some dreamer who knows not the world I marched in from Calais to Moscow. And he slept on in the old sarcophagus while the aeroplanes droned their motors between Napoleon's mausoleum and the cool night stars. Again, I encourage you to look up the poem and take time to read through it and see the heavens above, the earth, the waters below. He has all of those ingredients included in the poem to make this powerful, beautiful point about how much we think we can comprehend and control the world in our wars. But in reality, there is an eternal thing. There is a weight of history that goes way beyond what we think we're accomplishing with it. And again, I'm not saying that as a pacifist. I'm not saying that as a person who says we should never use force to stop evil or to do something that's unjust. I'm not that person. I am grateful for our ability to defend those who are vulnerable, to defend our own shores. I'm grateful for that. I think we should recognize the gravity of when we're involved in war. And if any day is going to encourage us to do that, it should be Memorial Day. It is Memorial Day. And so even those who oppose a war, generally or specifically, should be able to respect the cost. I just want to wrap it up for you. Paid by soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, guardsmen, doing their best simply to move their life forward. Hey, I'm going to join the military, get a college education, go get a career, but they do it by serving their country. Even people who opposed the war should be able to respect the cost paid by those men and women, honoring the sacrifice of those who have lost their lives is always the right thing to do. So for each soldier, sailor, airman, Marine, guardsman, to each and every one, not because you were perfect, but because you were there when and where we asked you to be, for the sake of a nation unlike any other in the history of the world, we say thank you. And we pray for every family member who lost a son or a daughter, for every father or mother, brother or sister. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious unto you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.